Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and hello, 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 my fabulous friends. Welcome to the all-new, totally exciting season of Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents. I am your host, Chloe Dilly, and I'm back older, wiser, and more thrilled than ever to showcase the most amazing talents and inspiring stories from all around. This season is going to be an absolute blast. We're talking epic talents, heartwarming journeys, and maybe a few surprises along the way. Whether you're here to be inspired, entertained, or just have some fun, you're in the right place. So, grab your headphones, turn up the volume, and get ready to smile, laugh, and maybe even dance a little. Because this is Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents. Let's make some magic together. Kia ora koutou, and welcome to a very special episode of Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents. With the New Zealand general election coming up in November 2026, there has never been a more important moment to talk about what your vote actually means, why it matters, and what happens when people choose not to use it. My guest today is someone I've had the privilege of speaking with before. And since that first conversation, her life has moved at an extraordinary pace. She is 18 years old, she is a University of Canterbury student, she's the youth MP for Dr. Tracy McClellan, she's the national spokesperson for Make It 16 campaign, and she's the co-founder of the O3 Leadership Collective, a youth-led feminist organisation right here in Otatahi, Christchurch. She has stood in the New Zealand Parliament and given one of the most talked about speeches of Youth Parliament 2025. Please welcome back Ruby Love Smith.
Kia ora, Chloe. Thank you for having me again.
Ruby, welcome back to the show. When you were last here, you were already doing incredible things, but a lot has happened since then. For anyone who is hearing about you for the first time today, can you give us a quick picture of who you are and what you are currently involved in?
Yeah, kia ora ko Ruby Aho. I am a young leader and women's rights advocate based in Otatahi, Christchurch. I'm spread across a few organisations. I, as Chloe mentioned, co-founded the O3 Leadership Collective, so we're in the young woman leadership space. I'm also an advisor for Make It 16 and Gen Z Aotearoa, and this year I'm helping out on Tracy McClellan's election campaign, and I do a little bit of social media on the side as well.
You became the youth MP for Dr. Tracy McClellan in 2025. What does that role actually involve day to day, and what has surprised you most about it?
Yeah, so Youth Parliament is about a 6-month program that happens every 3 years. Each MP will select a young person to represent them at Youth Parliament. In the lead up to the kind of 3 days in Parliament, we do a lot of Zooms with the Ministry of Youth Development, a lot of training about how youth consultation should be done, how does Parliament work. I think it's a program that's very much you get out of it what you put into it, and also really varies on the availability of your MP. I know some people were really active with their MP. I would consider myself in that boat and kind of got to go and do community engagement with them, got to run an event with them, that kind of thing. Some people, their MPs were a lot busy, especially those whose MP was in cabinet. But I think there's still so many opportunities for people to do whatever they want in the space. And then obviously the kind of main part of it is the 3 days up at Parliament where everyone is put in a different committee, given an issue that we all go out and do youth consultation on, and then we present those findings to the relevant minister, as well as you get the option, you either get to ask a question to a minister, be the chair of one of those committees, or give a general debate speech in Parliament.
You are also a co-founder of the O3 Leadership Collective, a youth-led feminist organisation focused on advancing the leadership and civic participation of young women across the South Island. What was the gap you saw that made you want to create that?
So Mackenzie and I had both been working in the youth sector for quite a few years, and we'd noticed two things. The first was that majority of youth organisations or organisations working with rangatahi in the civics and leadership space were all kind of based in the North Island, particularly Wellington and Auckland. So that can make it quite difficult for rangatahi who don't have the financial means or the kind of support behind them to be able to get to those kind of events. And the other thing that we noticed was a lot of these organisations were focused on rangatahi in general. And as we know, young women face very kind of specific barriers to things like leadership. You know, majority of our CEOs in our country are men, and being a community that has faced a lot of systemic barriers, we really wanted to be able to meet young women where they are, work to address those specific barriers that they face, and also bring that to the young women in the South Island, and so people don't have to travel as much and everyone has access to that kind of support.
You are juggling university, a national campaign, co-founding an organisation, and a youth MP role all at 18. When did you first realise that this level of involvement was something you genuinely wanted rather than something you felt you should do?
I think I've always liked being busy. I really struggle in times like school holidays without structure. But before I was doing any of this, I actually wanted to be a doctor. And so I think I've always kind of wanted to do something that I can give everything to and that takes up a lot of my time. And I think maybe even like 6 months in to the youth kind of advocacy space, you progressively get busier and busier, and I wasn't hating it. And I think also when you're doing stuff that you're passionate about and that you enjoy, it's easier to kind of find the motivation to keep going. And, you know, those early morning starts, sometimes we're 4 a.m. flying to Wellington, and then we won't get back to our hotel till like 11 o'clock at night, and you have to do it again the next day. And it's during, to get through those days, sometimes it's, yeah, really important that you're kind of passionate about what you're doing.
You were on this podcast before talking about your bass guitar and your early involvement in local leadership. How does the Ruby sitting here today compare to the Ruby who first came on this podcast? What has changed most in yourself?
I think I'm a lot more confident in my abilities, and I think that sometimes that just comes from time and experience. And when I was here last time, I was very much kind of focused in the political partisan party space, and now I've kind of shifted over more into the non-partisan NGO space as well. And I think getting that different experience has made me more confident, I think, as well. I was more confident in my ability to kind of formulate ideas and come up with policy proposals. And I think since Youth Parliament, since the last time I was here, I've gotten a lot more educated and experienced on how to actually implement those kind of things, which has been nice as well. So I think, yeah, I think I'm more equipped to turn ideas into action, but also just more confident in my abilities as well.
Let's talk about your speech from Youth Parliament 2025, because it genuinely stopped people in their tracks. Before we hear it, can you tell us what you were feeling walking into that chamber and what you most wanted to say?
I think I was surprisingly not that nervous, but that was purely because I had been drilling that speech. I wrote my speech very early and I had been practicing it for hours every night for literally months. So I was very confident in that I was going to be able to deliver it. But yeah, I was still kind of stressing, and I remember I actually finished 10 seconds before the timer because I'd like cut out a part as I was sat there literally before I did it. And again, I had no notes, so I'd cut it out in my head, and so I was very much like, okay, I need to remember that I've changed this section. But yeah, I think I was feeling kind of quietly confident in how it was going to go. And I'd taken a lot of inspiration from Kamala Harris's concession speech and that kind of acknowledging the suffering that people were going through, but also ending on that message of hope. So I was really excited to be able to bring that kind of perspective to Youth Parliament.
Let's now hear Ruby's powerful speech delivered from the floor of the New Zealand Parliament as a youth MP. This is the speech that so many New Zealanders have now heard and shared. Here is Ruby Lovesmith at Youth Parliament 2025.
I call Ruby Lovesmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is not easy to be a young person in New Zealand today. We are the generation that grew up through crisis after crisis. The COVID-19 pandemic, the looming shadow of climate change, and for our Ototahi Rangatahi, March 15th, and the Christchurch earthquakes. Every time we turn on the news, another war starts, another city burns, another human right is stripped away. These crises haven't just shaped our past, they've shaped how we see the future. And when the future feels unstable, we start to ask, who is fighting for a better one? For many of our young people, the answer is not politicians. When one side insists the world is ending and the other seems determined to make it happen, it's hard to find anybody on our side fighting for us, telling us that we will be okay. Because the glaring truth is that our young people are not okay. There are children in this country who walk through the front gates of school without a lunchbox. There are children in this country who are forced to stay home sick because they can't afford to see a doctor. There are children in this country who are unable to dream of a future because they are too busy trying to survive the present. And if that is what back on track looks like, then I think it's time we consider where this track is heading. Yeah. However, despite all of this fear, anxiety, and uncertainty, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it is us, our young people. The rangatahi across the country who are fighting for a better future. When we walk out of the classroom and into the streets demanding climate justice, we create hope. When we stand on the front steps of Parliament and demand that the voting age be lowered, we create hope. When we put in the time and effort to connect with and support our communities, we create hope. Because we show rangatahi across the country, you are not alone. Our young people are fighting, and we are making change not with power, not with policy, but with empathy. If we can trust one another, we can believe in something bigger than crisis. We can believe in each other, and we can create a future better than the one we are currently promised.
That speech has been widely shared and deeply felt. What kind of responses did you receive after delivering it? And did anything surprise you about how people reacted?
I got a lot of messages that were young people saying that it was nice and gave them hope, being like, oh, finally someone's talking about this. Finally someone's saying something about that relates to my experience. And I found that quite interesting for a few reasons. I think it kind of speaks to how important acknowledging and listening to people is, and how even someone just feeling like they're being heard and someone cares about the things they're going through can actually make so much of a difference. And I think it also speaks to where we are politically right now, that the hardships people are facing are not what's being talked about. You know, what are the most talked about issues in politics and even New Zealand Parliament at the minute? A lot of it is identity politics and far-right rhetoric and debates around people's basic human rights, and those are really important, but the way they're currently being portrayed and debated about, things like the bill we're seeing going through at the minute of the definition of a man and a woman, it's just absolute rubbish, and it takes away from the real issues that people are facing right now. We're in a cost of living crisis. We have so many rangatahi who are struggling with their mental health, who literally don't even have the basics, and all our politicians can do is sit around and talk about how they want to legally define a woman.
Youth Parliament is often described as a stepping stone, but for you, it felt like something more than that. Do you see yourself continuing in political life beyond your youth years? What does that path look like in your mind right now?
I think a lot of people get into the mindset of I want to have this title. I want to be an MP. I want to be mayor. I want to be this. And then I'm going to be able to create this big change in this area that I'm passionate about. And I kind of have the mindset that if you were going to be creating change, you would be doing that anyway. And I think that's entirely possible without a title. I think we kind of need to shift our focus away from striving for a title and just striving for the kind of change that you want to see. So for me, I think in the future, I would love to have the capacity, the knowledge and the ability to help fight this war against the far right at the minute and kind of bring together unity and collectivism in our country and around the world. We're seeing so much division and hatred, and a lot of that as well, like this kind of far-right rhetoric, a lot of it ends up being around women's rights as well. And I'd, yeah, really like to have the ability to be strong in that pushback and how can we bring people back together.
We are heading toward the 7th of November 2026 general election, and this episode is about why voting actually matters. So, let's start simply. Why do you think people, especially young people, must vote? What is at stake?
Young people have such a unique perspective to bring. We have so many new ideas, but also we are the only generations and age groups that have grown up with this kind of looming shadow of climate change and have grown up through the COVID pandemic at such a kind of influential and developmental age. We are like the only people who are able to have that perspective and the impact that's going to have on our futures to be able to prioritize that and prioritize solutions that are actually going to have long-term effects for us. And that's what's missing in politics at the minute, because for our older MPs, for the older demographic that have the highest voter turnout, their priorities can be more short-term because this isn't something that's going to impact their futures, but it's something that's going to impact ours, which is also a reason I think we need to lower the voting age, because these major events are going to take place and we need to be able to listen to the generation that's actually going to impact, because they know how to prioritise those issues, prioritise long-term solutions and the kind of and be leaders of the intergenerational governance that we need to see.
One of the things that does not get talked about enough is what happens to the votes that are never cast. When someone chooses not to vote, where does that silence go? And how do politicians actually use it?
When people don't vote, it sends a message to the government that they can just keep doing what they're doing, and it takes away those checks and balances that governments need to keep them in line and to do the things that they actually campaigned on and act in the best interest of the country. Because if we stop pushing back against things, if we stop engaging politically, we're giving them free rein to do whatever they like. And I know a lot of people get very disengaged when governments are doing lots of awful things, and I know a lot of people feel like that at the minute, but that's why it's so important that we keep voting and exercising our democratic rights, because if we give up, then we actually just give the government free rein to do more of the things we don't want them to be doing, because nobody's going to stop them.
Can you explain, in practical terms, how an election result can be shaped not just by who votes, but by who stays home? Does a non-voter ever effectively become a vote for someone the person did not intend to support?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I was saying before, like most of the highest voter turnout is those older generations. And so if we don't go out and vote, and if our younger generations don't go out and vote, then we're ultimately voting for whoever the majority demographic that shows out wants to vote for. And that's not reflective. That will never be reflective of the direction people want the country to go in, because the whole country isn't participating. You're just hearing the voice of one group.
Every 3 years, New Zealand gets to decide who holds power in this country. In your view, is voting the single most effective tool ordinary citizens have to prevent the misuse of that power? And what happens when not enough people use it?
I'm not sure if it's the most effective, but it's definitely one of them, because voting is our opportunity to hold is our ultimate opportunity to hold the government to account, because if they're doing things we don't like, we can get rid of them. And that's one of the only powers that rests solely with us. Like, when governments introduce legislation we don't like, we can submit against it, but that's not binding. What is binding is the election result, and that will has the power, you know, to get rid of a government. And so it's really important that we do use the power, even if we want a government to stay in, to show them that they're on the right track. We have to go and do that, because otherwise, like I said before, we're taking away those checks and balances of the government. We're stopping holding them from account. And when we do that, we're giving them the authority and the mandate to just go in and do whatever they want, because nobody's going to stop them.
For the young person listening right now who thinks their vote is too small to matter, who thinks the system does not work for them anyway, what do you say to them?
I totally understand that. And it's so easy to feel like the system is against us, because it is. But the only way that we can change that is to keep participating, is to keep making our voices heard, is to keep kicking up a fuss and being loud and contributing in any way we can, because the second we give up, it's over. So I honestly think that there's nothing we can do apart from try. And yeah, we have to do something. Otherwise, we're just going to let them win. And that's not a solution. Things can only go downhill. Things can only get worse if we stop trying.
There is a common feeling, especially among younger New Zealanders, that all politicians are the same and it does not matter who wins. How do you address that cynicism? And do you think that it is earned, or it is something that has been cultivated deliberately?
I don't think it's been cultivated deliberately, but I also think that I also don't think that it's true. And the example I like to use for this one is, people often say that National and Labour are the same. And one of the big differences, I think, at least between them, is if you go on their websites, the National Party recognises the Treaty of Waitangi as New Zealand's founding document, and the Labour Party recognises Te Tuati o Waitangi as New Zealand's founding document. And anyone who's been through our education system, or hopefully most people living in this country, will know there is a big difference between those two documents and what that means for tangata whenua, and also what that means for us as tangata tiriti. And even something like that, how they recognise our founding documents, makes such a difference in the type of policy they introduce, how they think we should go about race relations in this country, and that partnership between Māori and the Crown. And that's just kind of one example of how different our two major parties are. But even if you look into the small things, there's so much difference in how these parties think we need to address the big issues. And I really encourage anyone who maybe thinks that to go and watch the leaders' debates and just see all the things that our politicians disagree on. A lot of them agree on what the big issues are, but they have very different ideas of how we approach them and how we solve those issues.
Voter turnout in New Zealand has been declining, particularly among 18 to 30-year-olds. What do you think is driving that disengagement, and whose responsibility is it to fix it? The politicians, the education system, or the young people themselves?
I don't think it's the responsibility of our rangatahi, but it's also, I think sometimes we just have to move away from that question of responsibility, because if the government aren't going to do it, then who it? And we shouldn't have to. We shouldn't be obligated to, but if we want something to change, then we just have to anyway. And I think, like I was kind of saying before, a lot of this disengagement comes from people, as you said in your question, feeling like the system is so against them and that their vote doesn't matter because things are never going to change. And we can't afford to believe that. We can't afford for that to be true, to be honest. And so, like I said before, we have to try. And same with engaging those groups. It's the government's responsibility, but if they're not going to do it, then we need to, because otherwise nobody is.
Beyond turning up to vote, what does meaningful civic participation look like for young New Zealanders in 2026? Is voting enough, or is it just the beginning?
I think voting can be enough. There's obviously so many more ways to engage, and I would definitely encourage everyone to, because the more you can participate, in democracy and in civics, the better. But I don't want to push that expectation onto anyone either, because everyone is struggling with so much at the minute and people just don't have the time or the means. But if they can, they absolutely should. I mean, anyone can make a submission on a bill. Anyone can do a deputation to council. And that's open to anyone. You can just go and present to your council about an issue you're passionate about, which is really cool. And I would encourage people to go and do that. And as well, meeting with your MPs, so many rangatahi do not realise that you can email your MP and ask to go and meet with them. And they love to hear from young people. They love to hear about what we're passionate about, what we'd like to see change. So I'd really encourage people to go and do that as well.
You are the national spokesperson for Make It 16, the nonpartisan campaign to lower the voting age to 16 in Aotearoa, New Zealand. What is the core argument for why 16 and 17-year-olds deserve the right to vote?
Yeah, so I am one of the spokespeople for Make It 16, and it's a really cool role to be in. My favourite reason that we should lower the voting age is a concept called hot and cold cognition. So your brain has kind of two modes of decision making. And the first one is your hot cognition, which is decisions that are in a high pressure environment. Things maybe like writing an essay, decisions around alcohol and driving as well, like in those high pressure environments, which is why those decisions wait till you're a bit older. But cold cognition is making a decision and making choices in a kind of low pressure, low stakes environment. So things like voting, things like making a card, like those kind of easy choices that you make day to day. And voting is actually one of those. You're in a low stakes environment. You've had plenty of time to do your research. And that developmental part of the brain develops a lot sooner. And so actually from a biological standpoint, 16-year-olds are perfectly capable of making an informed decision on voting.
Critics of Make It 16 often say that young people are not ready or informed enough to vote. How do you respond to that, and what evidence do you point to?
I think the informed enough argument is really interesting, because I'd argue that we are the most informed generation because we are digital natives. We have more access to information than any other generation before us. Like, our capabilities to go and research different parties and their policy with access to the internet is so much wider than it has been for any other generation. And on top of that, I think most adults are just voting based on how they feel and not based on actual research or education. So I actually think that lowering the voting age would be not only are young people skilled enough to be able to go and more equipped to go and do that research themselves, but actually if we couple that along with civics educations in schools, we actually have an opportunity to create the most educated generation that is voting going forward, who are the most informed and really understand the best way to participate.
The Supreme Court ruled that the current voting age is a breach of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, yet the law has not changed. What does that say about how seriously this country's decision makers take young people's rights, and what keeps you motivated to push forward despite that?
I think, like I was kind of saying before, for older generations and our decision makers, it can be quite difficult sometimes to understand the importance of these things. And again, with climate change, like the way that we feel about climate change as people who it's going to dictate our entire futures is quite difficult and a concept quite hard to grasp by those who aren't living it. And so we often hear things from our politicians of like, with everything going on in the country right now, cost of living, this is really what you're worried about. But actually to avoid these crises is really coming into play, like the ageing work population, which has the potential to tank the economy, and climate change. The best way to come up with the best solutions for those, which are really, really pressing issues that I think are just as important, is consulting our young people who can show you how important those are.
You have done important work exposing how political parties, especially the National Party, are spending on targeted advertising through meta platforms like Facebook and Instagram. Can you explain what you've found and why it matters for how New Zealanders understand the campaigns being run before they vote?
Yeah, so the Meta Ad Library is public, which is something I only realised recently because I stumbled across an American talking about it on TikTok. And I think it's just something that's quite interesting to look at. Like, there's nothing wrong with what they're doing. Everyone is doing it. But I just found it quite fascinating to see what kind of demographics they were targeting. And I think it can be quite eye-opening for voters as well to maybe understand why they are seeing so much content from a particular party and not another. And maybe just like attuning to that. It's what we call like media literacy, that kind of media bias that actually just because you're seeing a lot of content from this party doesn't necessarily mean that they're the most popular or they're the most aligned with what you believe. But actually that's just how the algorithm or how paid advertising is pushing that content towards you.
Targeted political advertising works by reaching people based on their behaviour, their fears, their uncertainties, often without them realising it. How does this kind of subconscious influence affect undecided voters in the final days or weeks of a campaign? And what should every voter know before they step into the booth?
Again, I don't really think it's necessarily a bad thing, but I would draw on the example that we saw, or at least I think a lot of our rangatahi found with Kamala Harris's campaign against Donald Trump. A lot of people were just getting, especially our younger generation who are predominantly on TikTok and the predominant users on TikTok, were getting just a lot of content from the Democrats and from her campaign, making them think that the lead she had over Trump was a lot bigger than it was. And it's because young people were more likely to be supporters of her and supporters of the Democratic Party in the USA. And so when young people are the primary audience on TikTok, majority of the content is going to reflect what they're seeing. Whereas if you were on Twitter, it would have been the absolute opposite. But because our young people weren't, I think they were all very surprised when the US election results came out.
Most people scrolling through Facebook or Instagram have no idea they are being served a political ad that has been specifically designed for someone with their exact demographic profile and browsing history. What practical steps can ordinary New Zealanders take to become more aware of when they are being targeted?
So you can either go on the Meta Ad Library, which is public for anyone, and just search in the account that you're looking for and you can see what audiences they're targeting. But also all paid advertising on Meta apps will say that it's an ad. I think it kind of pops up where the location of a post usually is, but it's always somewhere on the post. So just making sure, I guess, that you're checking that if it says paid advertisement or not.
Do you think New Zealand needs stronger regulation around political advertising online? And is that a conversation that is actually happening at a policy level, or is it being ignored?
I'm not sure. I think maybe the way the guidelines we have around how it's regulated in terms of what politicians can actually say in their advertising might need some evaluation. But I think as a whole, I don't see a problem with paid advertising. You know, businesses are doing it as well. It's a way for them to get their message out. And actually, when it's utilized correctly, it means that people are making more informed decisions because they will have seen what the parties are promising. They would have seen their policy announcements. And often social media is a really good tool to engage young people in that process and so that they can see what parties are promising. So I think when it's used correctly, it's a good thing, but maybe just limiting around what can actually be said in those adverts, who's checking how factually correct they are.
You were awarded a Girl Boss Award, and the initiative behind it is a really powerful example of civic action in practice. You saw children without shoes through your involvement with CYC and helped organise a public shoe collection to donate to those kids in need. Can you tell us about that and what it taught you about what one person can actually set in motion?
Shoe Drive was a kaupapa that was very close to my heart. So many young people in New Zealand are going without the basics, and there are a lot of children going to school in winter without shoes. And we were able to collect over 1,000 pairs of shoes from other schools across Ototahi and able to redistribute those to schools in need. Tom Richards led the initiative and he did an amazing job, as well as the team at CYC. I think it was very eye-opening to see the amount of need there was, but it brought me a lot of hope to be able to see the way people came together. And I was very grateful for when I came to Christchurch Youth Council with the idea, the way everyone got so behind it and got so involved and passionate and were actually able to make it happen.
That story connects directly to the bigger conversation about voting, does it not? Noticing a problem, deciding to act, getting others to join you. Is that not essentially what political participation looks like at every level?
Absolutely. And the power and influence that we can have when we come together as well, especially as young people, like that was an inter-school shoe drive. So it was being led by the school leaders in those schools or young people who were taking initiative. And I think it just shows that when we come together for a goal and for the common good, that we can actually make a real impact.
You are someone who clearly does not wait to be invited into the rooms to make change. You build the rooms yourself. Where did that instinct come from, and what advice would you give to a young woman who wants to do the same but does not know where to start?
I don't necessarily think it came from an instinct. When I was younger, I had a tendency, obviously a lot of the adults would ask, do you not get scared coming into these spaces? And I'll be like, no, I was lying. I was absolutely terrified. I would stay up fretting over having to send an email. Those kind of basic things that come so naturally to people who have done it before. I was 15. I had never sent an email in like a professional capacity. So I think it's just one of those things that you just have to get amongst it and just feel the fear and do it anyway. And remember that no one is expecting you to be an adult in the room. People are very patient. Everyone just wants to help. And I think as well, we have a tendency to look at people who have been doing things for a long time and maybe got to a point where they're starting their organisation and being like, well, I don't know how to do that. But actually, that's not the starting point. I think the starting point in these kind of areas is just learning from experience. And so I'd really encourage anyone who wants to get involved in politics or social change, social action, join your local organisations. Applications for Christchurch Youth Council are currently open, and there's so many other initiatives that you can go and get involved in. So I'd really encourage anyone. You don't have to take all these things on by yourself. You can learn from others. And yeah, I think just getting your foot in the door and starting to work with a group of like-minded young people is definitely the right way to go.
With the election coming in November 2026, what would you want every New Zealander, regardless of age, to understand before they vote or decide not to vote?
That democracy only works when we vote in and participate in the best interests of the country, not the best interests of us as individuals. There's a concept called the tyranny of a majority, which is where the dominant demographic in a country, that's whose interests are going to be reflected in voting, because we have a one person, one vote system, which is a good thing, but it also means that for minority communities, groups like Māori, different ethnic minorities, LGBTQ+, and those kind of groups that have whose needs and interests are really important but don't hold a big share of the population, if we all just vote for what we think is best for us as individuals, their needs and the things that are important for their community aren't going to be prioritised. And so I would like, and again, that's why I think civics education is so important, because democracy works when we're working in the best interest of everyone, not in the best interest of ourselves.
If you could design the ideal civics education for every young New Zealander before they become eligible to vote, what would it look like?
civics education needs to go beyond voting. Obviously, voting is important, and teaching our young people how to make an informed decision, how to find a party's manifesto, how to understand what politicians mean when they talk about different ministries. Things like the bureaucracy are really confusing. Economic policy, and we need to provide education as well as like education around things like financial literacy, so our rangatahi know how to break down what our politicians actually mean. But also it needs to go beyond just voting, and we need to be teaching about how to make a submission, how to contact your MP, and all the other opportunities that people have to engage democratically as well.
If Make It 16 succeeds and the voting age is lowered before the next election after 2026, what do you think changes in New Zealand politics? Does the conversation shift? Do the policies shift? And does the country look any different because of it?
I think if you remember under Jacinda Ardern's government, climate change was declared we declared a state of emergency on climate change, and it was a topic on everyone's minds. Everyone was talking about it because we had a leader who was very strong with intergenerational governance principles and who was really passionate about advocating for our young people. And I imagine that if we lower the voting age again, we would see a lot of those topics, the aging work population, climate change, long-term economic recovery, poverty, youth mental health statistics, which are appalling in this country, by the way. I think we would see those topics brought back on the table, actually talked about, actually considered in a way that they aren't at the minute.
You're 18, juggling university, a national campaign, co-founding an organisation and a youth MP role. What does a normal day actually look like for you? Like, do you sleep?
I do. Probably not enough. A normal day would usually begin with me sleeping past my alarm, going to my lectures, coming back, probably doing some paperwork, maybe filming some content, and then going back for another lecture, and then some kind of night class or meeting on at the end of the day, and then some more paperwork and Zoom meetings, I think. A lot of meetings, a lot of paperwork, and a lot of lectures.
If you could slide one piece of legislation through Parliament tomorrow, no debate, just done, what would it be?
I think reinstating the pay equity scheme. An improved version. I think some of the issues with it the government highlighted are correct, and we've heard that from the PSA and everyone else. No one was saying it was a perfect scheme, but it was an important one, and scrapping it entirely has so many. Not only is it a step backwards for the rights of women in our country, but it also has so many flow-on effects for poverty, for economic recovery, and being fair in how wealth is distributed in this country is so important. We like to think that we've come so far in terms of women's rights, and I think this just shows how quickly they can be taken away again. Care and support workers in particular do very difficult jobs, and a job that a lot of people, quite frankly, just do not want to do. It's hard work, it's honest work, but it's such important work. And I think this is sometimes we forget something that gets overlooked as well, is that we currently have a government who like to talk a lot about kind of backroom dilly-dallying and people doing jobs that don't contribute that much economically. And I just think that's absolute rubbish, that every job has a purpose, and even these jobs that they don't consider to be very aspirational, they're jobs that we need someone to do. We need to recognise that the people doing the difficult jobs and the jobs that most people wouldn't want to do are actually working a lot harder than I think a lot of people realise.
If the 16-year-old version of you could see you now, standing in Parliament, running a national campaign, founding organisations, what do you think she would say?
I think she would be very confused as to how I ended up anywhere near Parliament. But I think it's just, I think we often see things on social media and we see people doing big things and think that, oh, they must be, you know, they must have something about them that means that they're able to do that stuff. And I really want to push back on that. I think everyone is capable of doing anything that they want to. And like I said before, we see people who get to a certain point and go, wow, you know, they must have had all this to help them. But it's actually, that's not their starting point. And it's getting involved in your local organisations and going in at an entry level and working your way up that actually leads you to get to those spots. And a lot of people sometimes you'll see don't like to talk about where they've come from or the steps that have gotten to where they are today. But actually that's the stories that people need to hear.
What is the closest thing to magic you've seen in your work? A moment where you thought, I cannot believe this actually happened.
I think Shoe Drive is a really good example. The amount of young people who participated and got involved in that program, I just thought was incredible and unbelievable. And the engagement we had was just insane. You know, the amount of young people who were bringing in shoes, who were helping with lots of different parts of the organization of it, just shows that we can come together and do so much. And, you know, our target for the amount of shoes we collected was in the hundreds, not the thousands. So the fact that we got over 1,000 was just so mind-blowing to me. But, yeah, I think it just shows there is magic in the way that people are able to come together and work together and the change we're able to see. And I'm not much of a history nerd, but when I did study history, that seems to be just time and time again, the story is about the incredible things that we manage to do when we come together.
Would you rather have the power to make every eligible New Zealander vote in the next election or the power to make every politician tell the truth for one full week before the election?
I think that if we forced every politician to tell the truth, they would just have to not speak for a week. So I'm going to go with making sure everyone goes out to vote because, like I said, I'm such a big believer in people power. And if we had a 100% turnout, we would be able to do such incredible things to have everybody represented. And voting for the first time can often be a step in the door to participating in other ways. Often people will do that and be like, oh, I actually felt like I participated in that. That's great. I'm going to do this next. And it also gives them a personal stake in it. Like if you voted for a candidate and then they become your MP, often people feel a connection with that and they're more likely to actually go and engage with that MP as well. So yeah, I think 100% turnout would just be incredible.
What is something completely unrelated to politics that you are secretly really good at or really into right now?
That's a good question. I've recently got quite into journaling and photography. I love taking photos, a bit like you. We love taking photos. Whenever we hang out, my camera roll gets so full. But yeah, I love being able to, I think, capture moments. I'm not sure how good at it I am, but I really like journaling as well and like being able to create like cute little photo albums and just like little lists. And yeah, I don't think I am super good at the whole like aesthetic journaling, and you'll see people who are able to spend hours and they have lots of different cardboards and stickers. I'm like, I don't think I'm able to do that, but I do just like having cute little journals with just thoughts in, photos, etc. I'm quite like a sentimental person.
Final question, and we want a real answer. What gives you hope? Not politically, not strategically, genuinely, personally, what makes you feel hopeful about the future?
People. I think the way that people are able to persevere is just so magical. Like the fact that we all choose to get up every morning and participate in society and build relationships with each other and come together around different things, I just find so magical. And especially our young people, the way that, young people time and time again have been able to come together and create a brighter future for their generation despite the challenges they face, and the uncertainty always gives me hope and gives me a reason to keep going.
Ruby, this conversation is exactly why this podcast exists. You are 18 years old and you are already doing things that most people twice your age have not dared to attempt. You stood in Parliament. You are leading a national campaign. You are building organisations. You are asking the hard questions about who has power and why. And you are doing all this because you believe, genuinely believe, that ordinary people, young people, people who have been told their voice does not count, actually hold enormous power when they choose to use it. With the 7th of November 2026 election approaching, this conversation could not matter more. To everyone listening, please register to vote if you have not already. Learn about the policies, ask the hard questions, and show up. Because as Ruby has shown today, silence is never neutral. It is an unused vote and it is never yours to keep. It belongs to the future of this country. Thank you so much, Ruby. We are all watching and we are all cheering for you. Ka kite ana, everyone.
That's the show, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show and want to hear more, head over to plains.org.nz for past episodes. You can also subscribe on Spotify and Apple Podcasts to get the new episodes delivered right to you. Do you have a talent you'd like to share? I'd love to talk to you. Just email info@plains.org.nz to get in touch. Keep working on your talents. You are amazing. Until next time, bye!